I thought I would talk tonight about really something that's very provocative to me, and I think to a lot of people who are practicing this practice, and looking into maybe what does it mean, you know, to really become a, so to speak, spiritually deconstructed person. I can't think of a better word. Sort of deconstructing our usual kind of idea of what's important and discovering perhaps what's really important, what's the most important. And that's such a, it's such an interesting development or process because, you know, from a certain point of view, everything we're doing here is just sort of a crutch. It's all aimed at kind of really some kind of full nakedness of being. That's the aim here, is to be completely without a crutch and to be completely genuine in each moment and completely connected with the vastness that is reality. Vastness and depth that is reality. And yet we have to go through a lot of training and forms to discover this innate nature that we have. We call it, in Shabbat we call it basic goodness, which is really very profound, basic goodness. It's very, it's so primordially basic. We call it unconditional basic goodness. And that word unconditional is the one that I'm really interested in looking into a little bit tonight. Unconditional basic goodness. And how we live in a very conditioned, we tend to live in a very conditional way. And where we tend to get caught in those conditions. And we tend to, our mind tends to get small because we are so much caught up in particular views of things and particular conditions that we believe are real and permanent. And unless we really work at it, it's not easy to see the true nature of what's going on. Because everyone else is kind of doing the same thing. Everyone else is confirming your conditions and saying, oh, those are real. Oh, it's all real. Yeah. And the more you have that confirmation, the more difficult it is to actually remember that we're trying to go beyond that. We're trying to actually shed our dependence upon conditions. Now, we still have to live within conditions, and conditional existence is how we discover the unconditional. I'm going to try not to be abstract here. Even though this is a very kind of abstract, in a way, it lends itself to abstract thinking. But I thought of this really interesting metaphor or symbol for what I'm trying to say, which is that, you know, usually when our minds are fixated, that is to say, we're just convinced that the only thing that's important is to get from here to there. And we're totally focused on that, and we're totally worried about what would happen if we don't stay with the plot, stay with our plot, you know, our storyline. We have our storyline, and we more or less believe in it. We go along with our storyline believing it, and we try to accomplish something that will further or promote our well-being, and hopefully more than just our well-being, you know, and we're trying to do that, and that's good. But we tend to get attached to just a small view of things. And we do this, and here's the image that I thought of. It's sort of like this attachment is sort of like, you know, your hand, you're in a struggle to actually get from here to there. You're trying to get from where you are to somewhere better or less painful or more pleasurable. We're always kind of trying to get somewhere, get something. Because we feel that what's going on now isn't it. This isn't it. We think that it, whatever that is something, if we get it right, if we somehow figure out how to get it right, we will discover the it, the happiness, the ultimate happiness, or something like that. So we're always sort of tweaking everything to try to get comfortable, feel secure enough to take the next step. So this is what fixation is all about. It's really about this feeling of discomfort, and then you're just feeling of insecurity, really, because you don't really know what's going on. None of us really do know what's really going on. We just sort of come up with our game plan, don't we? But so since we don't really know what's going on, there's a kind of a struggle, a kind of a stress. And that stress actually, like when I say stress, look at my hands do. They do that, you know? So we're in this kind of state of trying to grasp a handle on in our lives to get what we want somehow, to get the next thing. So this position of a hand being like that, and so, just think of that, something comes along, you know, and you're meeting something that's coming along, and you're like, your hand is like this, because it's always like that. You're always grabbing another handle. And something comes along, and you try to feel it. Now, I'd like you to actually do this. Place your hand in just whatever, like could be like a claw, but just grabbing something, like a handle. And now pick something up, and just try to feel what it is. Feel it in that hand that's now in a fixated posture. Feel how difficult it is to feel it. Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it, to actually feel what's there. Because we're so accustomed to that grabbing at the handle. That's the form that we take with our mind, with our actions. We take this form of grasping all the time. And it's like a shape that our mind goes into. Sometimes people call it being hooked. We get hooked into things. And so we're kind of a hook. All of our senses are kind of trapped in that shape, you see. They're limited by that shape. Now, relax your hand and take the same object and try to investigate it a little bit and see what that feels like. It's a whole different world, universe, isn't it? That's the world of non-fixated mind, where you actually, what's coming up for you, whatever comes into your senses, you are available to feel it. You're available to investigate it. And in fact, there's no one position in which you're doing that. You're actually open, and there's a softness to it. You're not in a struggle. So the very nature of being in a struggle makes it hard for us to feel our world, what's around us. And it isolates us. We are stuck in our storyline and our version of, just you can think of a world of handles. All the handles that are, you know, very beautifully arranged in our world as though we're all, what are those therapists called? Not physical therapists, the ones who help people live their lives.
Occupational,
as though we're all occupational therapists. Creating, you know, a safe world for ourselves with all the handles in all the places we might need them. And so we're so used to that. So the first step really, the first step to what we're doing is to just see the hand that we are reaching for another handle all the time. To just see how we do it. It's not like some terrible thing. It's just what we're doing. And to actually admit and feel what we're doing. If we have to take that step first, without judging it. It's not that, oh, I'm bad because I'm holding on the handles. We're all doing that. We're all holding on the handles. But it's rather just to experience the truth of that and the limitation of that. Once you begin to see that the degree of limitation of that, that you don't have to be doing that, then you start to feel a real longing to be able to, you know, to have your hands back, to actually be able to touch and feel what's there. And then, you know, with that, you all kinds of creative possibilities open up. Right? You start to feel that you could, you know, God, you could, whatever. You could write something. You could investigate things that suddenly you have access to that you didn't have access to before because this shape didn't fit in that hole. This shape didn't allow you access to that at all. So now we're becoming more formless, you see. We actually are becoming, through meditation practice, more formless beings in a sense. The form is still there, but we're not completely dependent upon the form to feel okay. As the forms change, the forms are always changing that we experience. And so, you know, as meditators, we begin to relax with that changing nature, and we can feel, you know, what comes up next, and we can not know what to do with it, which is actually what happens if you're open. If you're open, you don't know what to do next. And that willingness to not know is the doorway to finding out something new. If you feel like you know, there's no room to discover something new. So we're constantly, this is the beauty of the spiritual journey, is we're, as we give into this kind of scary, non-fixated world, the way it really is, you know, there's so many possibilities and so much openness that it becomes challenging or threatening to us in a certain sense. And this is part of the journey of why we call it warriorship. That's why we use that word in Shambhala, bravery. Maybe bravery is an easier word. Warriorship sometimes is a challenging word for people. But it, warriorship in the sense that we are actually willing to be brave and experience not knowing what's going on and to experience all the varied possibilities and situations. Of course, that doesn't mean that we... The interesting thing is, when our hands aren't locked into a position like that, much more of our resources are available to us. When they're locked like this, we are actually very, very vulnerable to injury. Because we're so brittle. That kind of stance is extraordinarily brittle. And if something doesn't come along that fits, we're going to bump it, or we're going to scratch it, or we, you know, we can only do what we can do within that form that we are attached to. So this much bigger world of the unknown and the formless nature of our existence, which is really much more of a journey, of a discovery, journey of discovery, becomes something... which you can never really grasp it, that openness. You can't really grasp that. That's the tricky part. We'd like to turn that openness itself into another handle. You know? And Trigam Trungpa came up with a term for that. It's called spiritual materialism. You know, we want to turn the bigger world of the openness of how things really are into something manageable that we can then call, you know, mine. I'm now a spiritual person. That's another handle for me. But that's just another shape that we take in that case. We're just putting ourselves in another shape. The interesting thing here is that in truth, things take form and then dissolve. All the forms are coming and going, including our bodies. Everything is just coming and going. So we're beginning to learn how to be in tune with this reality of how things really are. And then, you know, you can actually have, begin to have a sense of going deeper into things, which is the other aspect of having this sense of non-fixated mind. Fixated mind keeps us in a particular dynamic because we're attached to a form, and when you're attached to a form, you relate to everything in that way, and everything kind of seems to present itself to you in terms of your form that you're attached to. So if your hand is like that, you know, everything that hits your hand or touches your hand seems to be, you know, giving you a message of some kind, that a particular message based on the shape of your hand. But when your hand is open and available like that, it's flexible. You know, you actually, things come and you can actually dance with them. You can move with them. You can have exchange with them. So it's less of a battle, you know, much more of a dance. But so this feeling of softness, which is what we're describing here, softness, actually, it's a gentleness, a softness of allowing yourself to feel and to be open. That softness, when you have that, you begin to see the dimension or the deeper dimensions of things. You begin to see it's not just a surface, not just a thing hitting up against you, but that there's a whole world, a whole depth to each thing. And that's where you begin to discover the meaning of being a living being, you know, living, breathing being. The meaning is in that communication, the depths of communication that can happen between you and your world. And you start to discover all kinds of other meanings in every moment. It's not like you discover one meaning and it becomes another handle. But rather, it's a sense that you discover a meaning, and it's really very intimate thing to start to discover the inner, the deeper qualities of your world, of around you, your ordinary everyday world. So that, you know, it's described sometimes, the sort of deeper experience of this through meditation, sometimes described as, you know, one drop of water is like meeting all the water in the world, you know. So there's a sense of getting to becoming kind of a universal person, and that you're really beginning to get to know the elements in a very personal way, the elements of your world, and you're beginning to understand how things really function, which is a whole other level of existence that we don't usually see. And it's not just seeing, you know, these interesting patterns like we might as a scientist, for instance, although there's nothing wrong with that approach to understanding things either. But it's more, well, I think, you know, sometimes what science reveals to us is that there are all these other worlds. And it kind of can open us up if we let it. But on the other hand, there are the deniers, aren't there? The deniers of what it means when you see all these other worlds. And so it doesn't, our habitual tendencies don't end, you know. They go right into everything, every aspect of our world that we create includes those aspects of fixation and rigidity or relaxation and opening, either possible in any profession. But it's really interesting. There's a great Buddhist teacher who his name is Mingyur Rinpoche, and he's the son of a very famous Buddhist master, one of like four sons or three or four or five sons, I'm not sure. But he's been to Boulder and he's taught, and he's just an extraordinarily deeply, you know, practiced and deeply, I would say, wise person, like our own teachers are both as well. But Mingyur Rinpoche decided one day that in order for him to really go deeply into truth and reality, he needed to shed all the forms, not just some of them, but he needed to shed the form of being a spiritual teacher. He needed to shed the form of being being someone's son, someone's father, someone, you know, all these forms. He decided he needed to go all the way, And he literally one day walked out of his house taking nothing with him. And this is in India. And he literally just, you know, we call it in Buddhism, we call it entered the action. Just, let's see what happens next. You know, just go. Let's see what happens next. And he did this for 3 years. And, you know, the stories are amazing what happened to him. You know, he almost died. You know, he was not treated nicely much of the time because he looked like a street person, basically, a lot of the time. But we're all going to be in that position someday, you know. Someday we lose our comfort blankets. What are they called? Comfort blanket? No, what's it called? Security blankets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that makes us feel warm and cuddly and safe. You know, sooner or later, we have to go without that. You know, sooner or later, things fall apart in our lives. And that's when, you know, oftentimes when people discover their larger lives is when the things start to fall apart. A lot of people say, oh, that was the best, you know, quote unquote, it was the best thing that ever happened to me when I blah, 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 had my heart attack or some horrible thing. You know, oh, it was the best thing that ever happened. Of course, you would never wish it on anyone. But oftentimes these interruptions in our, you know, the shape that we've taken, these interruptions in them give us a glimpse of a much larger world that we've been ignoring and that we've not been experiencing. But the key thing is, you know, that it's not that that greater world, I mean, we tend to think of the small world as comfortable and familiar. And therefore, we are very attached to it because we like comfort and familiarity. We don't like the fear that arises when we don't know, when the things are unfamiliar. So I often think of like Lord of the Rings and the Hobbits, you know. Mm-hmm. The Hobbits are these people who just love familiarity. You know, they have breakfast, they have second breakfast, they have elevensies, they have lunch. You know, they have everything that they do in their world that is very kind of human and cozy, you know. And there's something lovable about it, about their very predictable world that they love and we love. We love reading about it because it's sort of so kind of archetypal of how, you know, we would like our lives to be, you know. I mean, for me, it would be a fireplace. You know, I could spell it all out for you, what I'd like, what I'd like my life to look like, you know. A house and a field with a dog and fireplace and no financial worries, you know. A lovely wife who loves me and I love, you know, blah, 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 right? And that would be my comfortable existence, you know. I forgot where I was going. Where was I going right before I went on the Hobbits?
Security blanket.
Security blanket,
and
yeah.
Daily structure.
What's that?
Daily structure.
Yeah, daily structure. Oh, yeah, I was talking about the fellow who entered the action.
Yeah.
So we tell you, we tend to think of that kind of existence as being, I don't know, it's sort of like Christmas or something, you know. You know, you're a kid in Christmas and you know, someone's thinking about your well-being. You feel protected. You feel, you know, there's some wonder in it, like presents, what am I going to get? And there's the smells of the warmth of being in a good shelter. And, you know, there's all these textures and warmths that we feel make us safe and a feeling of goodness. And we're terrified of losing those to some kind of, you know, vast journey of unknown. You know, it sounds cold when you talk about it that way. And yet, you know, what makes up that world of warmth and familiar, all the things that, all the elements that make that up in reality, they have those same vast qualities if you're not fixated on them. You know, when we're really fixated on them, we weave it into, you know, a world that's going to last because we like it. We want it to last. We don't want it to be impermanent. So we kind of, that's the grasping part, you know, we kind of keep it going. You know, we're focused on keeping it going and on on having that feeling, on possessing that feeling. You know, we go into all these other trips with it, you know, and we mess with it. All we're talking about here is the same stuff, just not messing with it. It's all the same stuff. You don't have to lose it. You don't have to give it. You don't have to throw it away. You're just learning not to try to hold on to it, keep it, not try to, you know, right? So therefore, that's a very interesting point. But sometimes, because we are so imprisoned by our habits, sometimes it's good to just get a change of scenery, you know? Just leave home, go into a retreat cabin that you're not familiar with, and experience what it means to be alive, not surrounded by all the familiar things. So we do that. That's a practice we do in our community. Hopefully, eventually, you get to do a retreat. And just, even if you don't meditate, just leaving your familiar world and going into a cabin alone, you know, that for some people, that in and of itself is just unbelievably intense and amazing. I mean, you know, you think you're leaving your world, and then somehow you're sitting in retreat and all the same stuff is going on that were going on in your world. And you're thinking, well, those people aren't even here. But I'm still feeling the same problems. You know, the stuff we were blaming on other people. They're still going on in the retreat, and they're not even here. So, you know, you make a lot of discoveries of how much you are perpetuating things. You make all kinds of discoveries when you're alone in a retreat. But again, you know, especially in Shambhala, we're not trying to get away from others. Being alone is another way of being with others for us. It's actually a way to discover real relationship. Rather than dependent or, you know, fixated relationship, we're discovering all the stuff that we do by being alone so that we can really communicate with others, really be with others. And that's the goal here, is creating enlightened society. You know, the goal is that we could somehow start to realize that we're better off. We're actually better off in a world where we're not trying to control others and not trying to be, not being afraid of others all the time, but rather a world based upon some kind of mutual celebration of the incredible variety of experience and incredible possibilities of, you know, of creating together a world that works, that's not based on fear, not based on, you know, hail so-and-so, whoever you're hailing, you know, who's going to make your world right again, right? That's the idea, isn't it? You're going to find someone who's going to fix it. Choyo Trungpa, who was my main teacher growing up, I knew him from a young age. He said once that we're a society right now. We're a society of experts. You know, we're always looking for someone who has the answer, the expert who has the answer. So we go to all these experts to tell us what to do, but we ourselves don't actually realize that for the most part we can discover what to do ourselves. And yeah, we need advice. Definitely, it's helpful to have advice. It's good when like you have a pinched nerve in your hip, it's good to go to someone who knows how the hip works to help you to put, you know, to do the right things to fix it. But you have to do those things. You know, you have to actually take the actions. And then you discover, you know, that, wow, you know, that knowledge was available on the internet. I could actually, you know, I didn't necessarily have to spend all that money to get that knowledge, but somehow it helps to have someone there who knows what to do next. So we need guidance. We need community. We need these things, actually, to progress on the spiritual path. We actually do need those things. We need guidance in the sense of authentic, clear, enlightened connection with the world. So that that's at the core of our guidance. It's like a compass that works, and it knows true north. So you need to have that to have an authentic spiritual path. Otherwise, it's all just sort of, well, we think New York's that way. You know, we think enlightenment is over there somewhere, but we don't really know. But when you have someone that's you know, really deeply experienced to guide you, it's a whole different path. So you need that, and then you need to have both the support and the irritation of community. And it is extremely irritating, as you know. but it's also, you know, it's wakeful. You know, you're when you don't want to, someone mirrors you. When you don't want to be mirrored, someone mirrors you in this community. And whether you like it or not, it's time to wake up. You know. You thought maybe the worst thing is you thought you were awake. That's when it's really bad. You know, sometimes you think, well, I'm okay, and then someone mirrors you and you realize that actually you're completely holding on for dear life to your habitual patterns, and you didn't realize it. That's the beauty of community, is they help you to realize it when you get stuck, and they help you to realize it that your basic nature is already awake. They mirror that as well. Your wakefulness is mirrored as well. So I'm going to stop talking. And let's talk about this. It's an interesting topic, I think. Formlessness and the shape-shifting we do.
I have to just say one thing. Mm. Bill and I recently went to see Doctor Strange.
And I saw that, too.
It's 3D.
Yeah.
And it's like, that was like, there wasn't enough for a down. A lot of the time, it was all those different dimensions intersecting.
Yeah.
And it was kind of wild.
Disorienting a little bit.
Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Sure. You couldn't quite, you know.
Yeah.
Keep up with it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I just thought of that when I thought of tic-tac-toe. You know, there's a game of it that's three-dimensional.
Oh yeah.
And when you try to play that, it's completely different than just playing on the flat board.
Yeah.
So I went home for Thanksgiving, and it's funny that this is what you talked about, because it's what I've been thinking about so much. And you know, I grew up in Ohio, and really had a great relationship with my parents and a nice childhood, but you know, I've lived out west for a long time, and especially now that I live here, you know, I meditate a lot, and like, you know, there's a lot of times I feel like, you know, I'm really getting it, like, I'm doing so good, and so I go home, and when I go home, I sleep in the same bedroom that I grew up in, and it looks a little different, but I completely lost it. Like, I was like a 16-year-old kid just bitching and complaining about, I was fighting with my sister. Like, days went by and I wasn't meditating, and it was amazing how I just slipped back into these patterns. And that is actually my comfortable place. I mean, I really enjoyed growing up there and stuff, but like when I go there, it's just amazing how I was just like, I've got nowhere. Like, I'm you know, I'm 16 years old still. And it's funny how that, you know, and I guess the good part is, like, I saw it. Like, that's the good part, you know. And so that mirror of my family really worked well to show me, like, how quickly I can just fall back into that, you know, and just being so rigid in everything I do. And can you speak to that at all?
Like, oh, definitely, yeah. I think everyone experiences some version of that when they go to their family. I mean, for me, one of the greatest horror stories is Thanksgiving at my home was truly, truly remarkably difficult. You know, for one thing, being the Buddhist, you know, the Buddhist. My mother used to say Buddhist.
That's what my mom calls me, is Buddhist.
Buddhist, yes, Buddhist. And then everyone would, like, turn to me and fire questions at me, you know, and then I'd start to answer, then they wouldn't be interested in the answer. They'd fire the next question. It was testing you. I think, you know, one of the things about that is that you realize that everyone has a sense of your place in the family, you know, who you're supposed to be in the family, and everyone identifies, and everyone knows your buttons in your family. Everyone knows what you're sensitive about, and So they'll go right for the buttons if they think that you're putting on airs. They'll go right for the button. And of course, this whole thing of being a meditator, you know, people think, yeah, right, you know, yeah, sure, and then they go right for those buttons. But in a way, it's like your tongue going for the sore in your mouth. You can't help it. You got to do it. You know, no one can help themselves. It's very, very much sort of human nature to test each other in a certain way. You know, I mean, when I lived in New Zealand, that's the style of the culture. Is people, they call it taking the piss out of you. That's what they call it, taking the piss out of someone, and they will challenge you by making fun of you and see whether or not you take yourself seriously or not. Because if you're taking yourself seriously, they go, oh, you're all, nah, you're not there. No sense of humor, poor guy, you know, takes himself seriously. So they're always kind of prodding each other. And there's a, you have to be, you know, it gets you out of yourself. You basically aren't supposed to be so fixated on yourself. So it's a cultural kind of thing, way to kind of say, hey, you know, there's a bigger thing than just your own stuff. But I think that what you're describing is one of the greatest tests of a practitioner is going back home. And I discovered over time the answer to being able to be there and not lose it was a sense of humor. That was the key for me in my family, was to not take it personally what people were saying and doing. And then, as long as you have a sense of humor, people feel like you're not making a big deal about who you are, what you do. And then they're okay with it, generally speaking. But when you know, like I used to go out to dinner with my mother, and she'd look at me and she'd go, are you meditating now? And I wasn't talking for like 1 minute. You know, are you meditating? And I have to go like not look like I was, you know, not be mindful was the key point. Don't be mindful or I will upset the apple cart. So that's actually the key thing I think about being with family is the key neurosis is that people are threatened if you change. It threatens people because then they're losing the comfort of having your the reference point of you as you in the family. You know, you have a role and a place, and if you're going to change that, everyone feels a little bit threatened, and so people try to keep you in your role. They try to keep you the 16-year-old, and I think that goes on forever in a family. Honestly, that stuff. I saw a Rinpoche. His brother come and the brother thing going on between two Rinpoches. I saw that. What at least what I perceived as being a similar dynamic, you know, a kind of they know each other so well that it's sort of like, you know, well, you may be a famous Rinpoche to them, but to me, you're just John, you know, you're just Lee, you know. So sense of humor.
I was thinking, just a part of what you're talking about was the not knowing, and not and knowing, and certainly have the experience of gaining more information, knowledge, wisdom when I don't know, and I know the block, but it's kind of an itch. You know, I was really bumped up against that this week, where it's like, shit, I don't know anything, and then it's like, and then logically, but I can't say I don't know anything, because, you know, I have gotten some kind of understanding, but it's continually reveals itself that there's tremendous amounts I don't know, and then there's the edge of where I think I know something, and then I find out I don't. You know what I mean? It's
totally.
It's just like,
yeah,
I don't want to know it all because I want to keep going, but I can't say I don't know anything. And who is it that knows anything? You know that whole thing. You know, so.
And
that's like the funhouse mirrors.
You're right, exactly. So,
yeah.
It's kind of baffling. Irritating, but don't know if it's any use to find the accuracy or what, but.
Well, you know, there is this kind of best of knowing, It's called the best knowing. It's called prajna, is the word in Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. Best knowing. And that's when all the labels fall away and you're face-to-face with just what's there without any kind of game plan or labels. And that doesn't mean you don't already have knowledge. You do have all kinds of knowledge about your world. And you gain more knowledge by being present in your world. You actually gain real knowledge, the best knowledge. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you start to actually learn what's really going on. And then you can trust that prajna more and more and not try to go back to just you know, ordinary knowledge.
Well, I just thought of something.
Yeah, go ahead.
Analogy.
Yeah.
It's like holding on to that comfort of knowing and thinking I know something.
Yeah.
Then having it ripped away and realizing,
oh, yeah.
Shit, I don't have my blanket.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Yeah, which is called the path, you know. That's the path, yeah. And so the path is all filled with these contrasts of, you know, feeling like, wait a minute, what is this? All of a sudden, I don't know. But that's only because you're used to knowing, feeling that you know, that you have that feeling. And so that's a journey quality. Over time, the more that happens, the more you don't necessarily feel that you should know, you know, or that it's a problem that suddenly you don't know. It ceases to be a problem, and instead it's just an openness, an opening that you're accustomed to. You become accustomed to the openness. But, you know, another piece of this is really studying, what we call it studying the Dharma, you know, is a big piece of what we're talking about here, when we're talking about knowledge. Because actually understanding, you know, the language of the Dharma as spoken, especially spoken by really realized people, you know, people who really are awake, gives us a vocabulary by which we can live with less form. It's like the vocabulary of non-fixated mind. And once you have that vocabulary, the language of that actually helps you to inhabit that world. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a handle. But it's a handle that is much less dense. Mm-hmm. Eventually, even those handles obviously have to go. But those handles are really pretty awake. They're pretty connected with how things really are. So that restudying the Dharma, you know, you really begin to... your mind begins to shift more into that kind of thinking, non-fixated thinking. Which helps when you're getting fixated, then you can actually use your intellect sometimes to help you to kind of see that you're getting caught. So it's a multi-pronged approach to destroying the ego, to getting past, you know, our just fixated tendencies. There's many, many, and that's why, you know, it really takes a lot of work to takes a lot of time and work to really soak yourself in the path, in the meditation path, because it involves a lot of study, a lot of practice, and that, you know, once you have the foundation of that, then whatever you're doing, you know, becomes much more of a teacher of that. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.